I'm Luther Peterson, a parish pastor from Minneapolis, and we're talking about some parables from the Gospel of Luke this week. We're going to look at these parables mainly from the viewpoint of disadvantaged people in the world. Some of this will be voices from Latin America, and we're talking especially about the viewpoint of liberation theology, which is simply to say that there are a lot of folks in Latin America who are in the church, but who no longer have decided to simply be a puppet of the state or of the dictators or of the government, and have decided to do some thinking for themselves and to study the Bible on their own and to care about people. And a lot of very profound writing has come out of this. And the bookstore and the library have a lot of those books, and we'll be looking at some of those throughout the week. I'll be having five of these parables, and I believe Maynard Johnson has another one of the parables on Wednesday. So 6 days in a row, if you're here all that time, and come to Bible study, you'll have parables from Luke. Let's begin with a word of prayer. Lord God, open our hearts and our minds today to hear your word to us, and open our eyes to see where you are working in the world in ways that we may not always have realized before. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. One of the books that I'll be referring to, or at least one that is a key book for understanding Luke and Acts, is the book by Walter Pilgrim. He's not from Latin America, but he writes a lot of things about Luke and Acts, especially as Luke deals with the whole question of poverty and riches. He comes at it at least partly from that point of view. And I would certainly refer you to this as a fresh and interesting new way to look at this book of Acts and Luke, the books of Luke and Acts. And that's in the bookstore, Good News to the Poor by Walter Pilgrim. I want to just mention before we start that best way I feel to have a Bible study is to have lots of discussion and just somehow get my attention. If you want to break in and raise a question or contribute something, once my mouth gets going, it's kind of hard to stop it sometimes, but just break in and let us know what kind of a thing you're concerned about, or if something doesn't become very clear, or you say you want to try to understand something a little better, or if you want to debate or argue, that's great. This is the kind of a wide open style that I like, so I won't feel bad if you break in from time to time. One of the things that we hear, or maybe we've said it quite often, is so-and-so is a really nice person. She is so thoughtful and kind, but she's a Mormon. Or you might say it the other way around. There's that person down the block, and then you might name another denomination. Could even be one of the denominations like Catholic or Salvation Army or just anything different from our own. And you'd say, but that person is very nice, as though somehow you can't quite imagine that they would be, but they are. Well, that's the kind of thing we're dealing with here this morning. We have that fellow called the Samaritan. And it raises the question, people who are different from us, who have a different theology from us, a whole different way of looking at life, and they sometimes are very nice people. And we can't understand why, because they may not have the same Apostles' Creed, and they probably haven't gone through Luther's Catechism like we have, and we can't figure out how they come out to be such nice people. But they do. I recall the Civil Rights Movement, especially in the 60s and 70s, a lot of folks who had just a lot of concern and did a lot of great things in the Civil Rights Movement, but they had no time for the church. I recall one fellow in our first, in the town that we lived in, in southeastern Minnesota, a small town, and it was our first parish. This fellow was the MD in town, the doctor in town. He had absolutely no time for the church. But talk about a community worker and one who cared about people and who really had a lot of the basic same philosophy of life and caring that I did. So I got to know him as a very good friend. But he had absolutely no time for the church. What about these people?
Obeying the Great Commandment, isn't that all that's necessary?
Well, they're certainly obeying the Great Commandment that that you shall love your neighbor as yourself. And we're going to be looking more at how that ties in with the other Great Commandment after a while. You shall love God and above all things. But this is a difficult question because we catch ourselves talking that way and we hear other people talking that way all the time. How do you deal with agnostics, atheists, and other quote unquote non-Christians who do so much good for people who are hurting? Let's read the parable. Somebody go ahead and read it for us.
A lawyer stood up to put him to the test, saying, "Teacher, what shall I do to inherit eternal life?" He said to him, "What is written in the law? How do you read?" And he answered, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, and with all your soul, and with all your strength, and with all your might, and your neighbor as yourself." And he said to him, "You have answered right. Do this, and you will live." But he, desiring to justify himself, said to Jesus, "And who is my neighbor?" Jesus replied, "A man was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho, and fell among robbers, who stripped him, and beat him, and departed, leaving him half dead. Now by chance, a priest was going down that road, and when he saw him, he passed by on the other side. So likewise, a Levite, when he came to the place and saw him, passed by on the other side. But a Samaritan, as he journeyed, came to where he was, and when he saw him, he had compassion, and went to him, bound up his wounds, pouring on oil and wine. Then he sat on his own beast and brought him to the inn, and took care of him. And the next day he took out 2 denarii and gave them to the innkeeper, saying, 'Take care of him, and whatever more you spend, I will repay you when I come back.' Which of these do you think?"
Which of these?
I lost my place.
That's okay. Take your time.
"Which of the 3 do you think proved neighbor to the man who fell among the robbers?" He said, "The one who showed mercy on him." And Jesus said to him, "Go and do likewise."
Okay. Thank you. All right. Just a little background on this parable. Jericho, the road to Jericho is a steep road with lots of rocky areas and good places for muggers to hide, which they often did. And it was just a dangerous place. It was dangerous for one person to travel it alone. Too bad that back in those days they had to have places where it was dangerous to be out alone, huh? Sort of like a lot of places nowadays. Well, anyway, they said that in the 5th century, one of the historians writing in the 5th century says that this road from Jerusalem to Jericho was called the Bloody Way. And even as late as the 19th century, it was still necessary, if you really wanted to be safe, to pay somebody to give you a little protection. So Jesus, when he was talking about the road from Jerusalem to Jericho, knew it was painting a realistic picture. This is the way it was. This is the way things happen. So he starts out. This fellow starts out from Jerusalem to Jericho, and then he goes on and tells us the parable. But there's a situation that that causes Jesus to tell the parable, and let's deal with that first. Okay, there's a lawyer. That's simply a person who is an expert in the law of God in this case. Sometimes this is translated scribe. Someone who knows the law of the scriptures. So this fellow stood up and he was just really searching for some help from Jesus, right? Just trying to see if you're awake. He was what?
He's testing.
Yeah, he was putting Jesus to the test, right? He was having some, he knew what this was all about. He was an expert. You know, he knew the law better than anybody else. He carried the law with him. In fact, he had little phylacteries, they called it. They carried little ornaments on their arms, and in those were in little, like a little case, there was written some of these summaries of the law. So Jesus answered him, how do you read? What is written in the law? How do you read? In other words, what do you read on your sleeve, you know, that you're carrying around? And the fellow replied, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength, and with all your mind, which is a summary of the first few commandments, as you know, and you shall love your neighbor as yourself, which is the traditional summary of the last commandments. And that could be the 3 and 7 or however you number the commandments. So Jesus simply said, well, you've said it, you've answered it right, do this and you will live. Goodbye, you know, that's fine, okay? But this fellow wanted some more help, is that right? He was searching for more help, is that what he was doing? No. Trying to justify himself. Do we ever try to justify ourselves? What happens, or how is it that we feel that makes us want to justify ourselves?
Guilty.
Uh-huh. All right, so he wanted to justify himself, and so he asked Jesus, who is my neighbor? Who is my neighbor? What are some ways that question is asked nowadays?
Some people seem to think it's easier to just shut it off to some far country rather than helping people that
live
close to them.
Aha, so you might say, but they're awfully far away. You know, don't we have people closer to home? Shouldn't we take care of those here first? Okay, other ways that you hear that question being asked nowadays. I'm sure none of us have ever said that or asked questions.
The problem is too big for a single human being. Better leave it to the government.
Ah, it's just too big. It's too much for us to deal with. Okay, any other ways of saying, who is my neighbor?
So little I can do.
So little I can do.
Are we involved with these people? We don't like them very well. They're not our class.
Yeah, they're not. I just wouldn't know how to deal with that. It's just too different from us. Other ways we might ask the question.
Refer them to, Salvation Army's social worker going on it.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Services to take care of this.
Yeah, there are things set up for that. Yeah, we're dealing with these things, and there are people who are trained, and there's people donating for it, and thank God there are. But that can be a cop-out. Right. Any other ways that we might ask that question?
Well,
back
I think
here.
We should find out more about the situation, you know, before we start getting mixed up with this.
Aha. Let's get more information. Okay.
Yeah, there's a cop-out on picking out their human faults, like they don't do this or they don't do that. I found that a big cop-out with the Asians. And,
oh, yeah.
You know, this one has the wrong attitude.
They don't deserve it.
And they only came up over here because they knew the United States was going to provide for them for a while. And, you know, they just want to get on our relief system.
Okay. All right. Okay. Good insights there. Any others here?
We have our own to take care of.
All kinds of ways, yes.
Am I my brother's keeper?
We have all kinds of ways of saying that.
Well, I'm thinking of just like our neighbor next to us. We don't even take the time to go over and find out who it is, although he might be a very good neighbor if we try.
Yeah, and this is so true in the United States nowadays that we just don't know our geographical neighbors either. Yeah, and so there are a million ways of saying these things. These are statements which are sort of true in some ways, but we can use them in a way to escape if we want to. It's not that we're simply saying right now not lies or being just evil people, but we just sort of have a little way of kind of twisting them just a little way so we can just kind of wiggle out of something.
I've been saying to myself, Jesus taught us that we can only take one at a time in the Good Samaritan. Take care of them as they come, and then...
Okay, and you know that's...
That's a cop-out, I know. But.
Well, you see, it's like all these other things. There's a truth in it, but it can be used as an escape. And that's the kind of thing that we need to watch out for, isn't it? Well, let's just take a look at these characters. We have the traveler. Maybe he was stupid and traveling alone. We're not sure about that. Anyway, he got mugged and was laying there looking like he was dead, not moving anyway. And you have the priest and the Levite. I know traditionally those who interpret the scriptures and write little explanations of the parables say, well, the priest represents the church and the Levite represents simply those who are scared to take risks. And maybe this is true. I think it's been divided up that way so that people can have nice, neat Bible studies. But anyhow, between the two of them, they were... One of the priest and the Levite were using their religion to escape. The priest knew and the Levite, I suppose, knew also that if you touched a dead body, if the guy would happen to be dead, and he touched him, he wouldn't be able to go over to the temple and perform the rituals that he was supposed to do. He wouldn't be able to do that for 7 days because he'd be unclean. And I suppose you could call this what kind of a cop-out?
Religious
cop-out, yeah. And whether it was the priest or the Levite that were thinking that way, either one of them could have. Either one of them could have said, that may be a trap. There may be somebody hiding behind the bushes there, and if I come over, why, he'll clobber me too, and that'll be the end of it, so at least one of us better get away free. That's something that can happen to church people or non-church people. We're just afraid to take risks, I suppose. But those are a couple of common motives. Any other reasons why you think that these fellows might not have gone over and helped them? I probably wasn't one of ours anyway. Okay, other thoughts?
It might cost them something.
Might cost them something. Okay, I'd like to have you just... divide up into little groups now of anywhere between 3 to 5 people. First thing, just kind of turn your chairs and if it's people you know, that's fine. If it's somebody in the little group of 3 to 5 that you don't know, I get acquainted first. And then what I'd like to do is have you answer the question, how do we do this today? What are some ways that we rationalize not helping people that are really hurting today? Just take a couple minutes. Just kind of turn around in little buzz groups, and just kind of just be sure you know everybody in your group first, and then do that. So let's just hear what a few things that you came up with. Let's just go right around, and one person from each group just kind of give us a quick word on what your group said. How about this group?
Well, for one thing, we think that a lot of people are helping today.
Okay.
And that one reason that people try not to is they're afraid of either committing themselves time-wise or they're afraid of being hurt in return.
Okay, all right. Very good. This group.
Well, I guess we felt that there's too many people feel there is a risk in getting involved. Suppose we found someone along the road. We're afraid of the law coming in if something happened to that person. Everybody is so happy now.
Afraid of lawsuits. Uh-huh. Yes. All right. Okay. Yes.
We discussed, we felt that perhaps by giving through large organizations, you read so much about it, that such a small percentage of the funds that you give really reach the people whom you want to reach. And therefore, you say, well, I'm not going to contribute to this organization.
Okay, we have a fear because of that, yes.
This young man had a refinement on that one.
Well, a little additional thing to that, so maybe they buy, this is just sort of on a humorous note too, so they'll buy a video cassette recorder instead and give the money to the poor in Japan that are working in factories.
Yeah, right. Okay, did y'all hear that? Okay, any others that want to, yeah, right back there.
We discussed a little bit when he said we're too busy to get acquainted with our neighbor, or we just don't take the time. The expansion of that is also that we are turned off by programs that bring this information to us of the needy, because we get frustrated and we don't like to face that frustration. So we've had people in our churches say, oh, that just turned me off. That's not my thing.
Yeah.
And is it our thing? And even if we have other interests, is God calling us to expand, to do those interests? Yes, but to also hear this one, which is so basic of the commandments.
Okay. We just somehow get something that insulates, something gets built into us, and we say, oh, that turns me off. And so it does. All right, any others quickly here?
How about prejudice?
Prejudice. Mm-hmm. Okay, prejudice is one. Over here.
I personally felt that after seeing the movie the other night about this Catholic priest and his efforts towards the poor, it seems to me like the Catholic Church as such is one of the wealthiest churches in the world. Why doesn't the church help some of these poor get on their feet and do something for them? Maybe that's a good cop out too.
Yeah, which movie was that again? We've got a couple of them here. Okay. And that's what the what Catholic Church in South America and Latin America is having, this change, this about face, and since the last 15, 20 years are beginning to do that, you see.
Some people are beginning to see what the church is doing wrong, and that their sense of direction in helping the South Americans is not good.
Okay.
Is there any point in training a woman to be a young woman to be a beautician or a stenographer, or to try to live in that area the rest of her life, and or young men to be what do you call it, engineers or whatnot? Yes, engineers, I think you need. But one priest is no longer a priest. Ivan Illich.
Who?
Ivan Illich, the priest who left the church.
The writer who writes.
And he's a writer, yeah.
Yeah.
How we're all wrong about how we're trying to educate.
Yeah, he writes a lot about education. Okay. Would you say a little bit more about that? I'm not sure I quite understand the exact point.
I'm criticizing the direction in which much of our help is going. We don't have a proper sense of direction in helping people very frequently.
Okay, and by that you mean the way that government agencies help?
We want them to be like us.
Oh, okay.
We want them to have the kind of... All right. Values we have.
Okay.
Training a beautician. Well, they
we
don't need a beautician.
Okay. Now I'm a little bit dense this morning. All right. I think I've got your point now. Yes. And this is so often the way we try to help folks in many countries, trying to make them more like Americans, more like North Americans, or and think like we do, and dress like we do. Okay. Good point. Good point. All right. Any other groups now that have a report here? Yes.
One along the lines of prejudice is that people could say, well, we shouldn't have to help this group or that group, because if they would only work, if they weren't so lazy, they could get to where we're at, assuming that they had the same lines open as we do.
Okay, good. You all heard that now. Over here.
That kind of goes along with what she says, too. In this country, I think we want to make other people over into the kind of Christian we are, instead of finding out what their needs are.
Okay.
If the priest had dragged this guy to the temple, instead of binding up his wounds, that's about what we often do.
Okay.
We say, well, if you profess this way, or if you take these four steps, or if you express this kind of testimony, then you are sure you're saved. And,
all right.
And we're trying to help people so much that way. Instead.
Yes, even in this country. Excellent. Yes.
I suggest that there are millions of people in our country who have plenty of butter on their table and a car in the garage, but whose hearts are aching and who feel broken and lack of esteem, and they're searching and they need help. And so many of us have the opportunity to help that person like themselves and feel good and believe in themselves by greeting and by being a neighbor. Yes. By going, by saying hello, but we, because of lack of confidence, we feel that we might be rebuked or we feel that we might not be accepted ourselves. Why we just look straight ahead and go our own way. I think there's so many people that need our help in that way.
Yes, that's excellent too. There may be someone at Holden has a broken leg. You can see that. Maybe there's people here who have broken hearts and you don't see it, but they may very much need some kinds of care and love just as much as a person with a broken leg. Okay, any other groups that have to have something to report here? In your same groups now, would you just do this? Suppose some estranged or some needy person from the neighborhood comes to your church office, wherever your church is located. Share with the others in your group how that person is helped or not helped. What kinds of things are set up in your parish? Things at the disposal of those who are in charge, like the pastor, whoever is there, what kinds of funds they have, for instance, what kinds of arrangements they have to help, whether it's transients or someone who comes in hungry. Just share that with each other, just to share some ideas here. You probably have more you'd like to say, but let's just get some ideas that have come out. Just a couple of good ideas from each group, or one idea, just raise your hand and share if you'd like. Yeah.
We have a food bank as well as an emergency expense fund with the pastor who, after counseling and he feels they have need, he has the funds to help them.
Okay, all right.
We also have a Thanksgiving and Christmas basket for needy families in our parish.
Okay, those are people that are in the parish?
Mm-hmm.
All right, and you help each other. All right, others? Yes.
There's also a group of about three in our church that run what they call the SQUIM Community Aid. It's in addition to the food bank. And they have clothes and stamps, similar to food stamps that they issue to these people that can go to the store and buy what they want instead of giving them cash.
Uh-huh, sort of vouchers-like. Yeah. Okay, over here.
The church that I used to go to near Washington, D.C., has a... someone cooked up the idea, instead of bringing in cans of food, which he usually forgot to bring in, every time he took communion, there was a basket at the back of the church. We took communion generally twice a month, although it was over four. And during the year, that collection brought in over $800, and this was given to Lutheran Social Services in Washington, D.C., that bought cans of food that were needed for their shelves.
Okay.
And I always thought that was a super efficient way of doing it.
Okay. All right. Good. Yes.
Well, I think you were talking mainly about people that come to the door of the church.
Yeah, that too. Either any of these things,
yes.
Fine.
Well, there's a fund in our church that they do have for that, but there's also the problem with those type of people because it's a church that's centrally located, and the secretary sometimes has a fear of that type of thing. And they do give a fund, but they also have an assistant pastor there that kind of controls us to see who comes to the office and who doesn't.
Okay. Okay. All right. That just reminds me. I'll just toss in something here at this point. We had an occasion like that in a parish in Waterloo, Iowa. This was a centrally located downtown church, and it was a Saturday morning, and I was in the office, and this fellow came by and needed some help, and we had a similar discretionary fund that could provide a voucher for a person to get some food down at the local restaurant. So I visited with him and wrote out a voucher, and he went on his way. And later that day, I believe it was, must have been either late morning or early afternoon, I had a wedding across town at another church. The pastor was gone, and I promised to take his wedding for him. So I was over in his office, and sitting in his office,
And the same guy, he came, and I just laughed. I said, where have I seen you before? But he just laughed too, because he knew that this was something he did, and that everybody knew that this is something he did, and he was going to be in town probably a couple days and be moving on. But it's a part of our American scene that we have to deal with, and I really believe the Salvation Army is dealing with that is better than the rest of us. My wife was the social worker of the Salvation Army in Waterloo, and that was about four blocks up the street, so I could always just call her as soon as I got the name of this person, and she would usually know the person and be able to tell me whether that person had already been there or ought to come up to the Salvation Army, and they could provide something that we couldn't, like groceries or clothes. And the Salvation Army did a fine job of coordinating the needs of a lot of people and helping us, so that we just encouraged our people and encouraged other churches to contribute to the Salvation Army. And I've just always been just amazed at how much they do. If you're not familiar with the Salvation Army, and sometimes we criticize them because they may have a little different theology than we do, and maybe don't celebrate all the same sacraments the same way we do, but they really do this work. It's just staggering how much they help. This is really something that I just didn't realize until Ruth went to work there, and I really have respect for them. Okay, other answers, other kinds of things that are happening. Yes, Ruth?
Well, I think we have to be careful not to use that as a cop-out.
Right.
People go from church to church, and he's probably gotten the same help somewhere else. So I think we have a responsibility to set up a referral system where we can find out from the agencies in town, because usually people will go first to those agencies that give help. And it's oftentimes after they've exhausted those funds that they go to the churches.
That's right. No, and that ties with what we said at the beginning, that there are all these things that we use as excuses that are true, but we have to be careful we don't use them as excuses.
And even if we do refer, to follow up and say, if the Salvation Army does say that they have not been there, it might be a source for you to get some help for this person too.
Right.
You know, as well
right.
as finding out what you can do to help the Salvation Army or the Christian Church.
Yeah, because from
your
position as a social worker of the Salvation Army, you saw churches copping out a lot too, didn't you?
Yeah, but I also saw where they would call it and say, has this person gotten help? No. And then I would help them know how they could help, whether it was get a hold of a certain gas station or whether they could find one of their members who knew how to fix something that I wouldn't have been able to.
Right.
I think this is something.
It isn't always just send them over.
Yeah.
Kind of an answer. All right. Any other contributions from your group? Some ideas that haven't come out here? Yeah.
In Wenatchee, we get an awful lot of the trenches in the fall, and it takes the combined work of all the churches to take care of them. They come before, you know, it's time to pick out. They can't all be employed, and there's sort of a soup kitchen open every day.
Okay.
And it takes everybody to do it.
Good. Churches.
And people don't pick up after themselves or anything. I mean, it's just the way it is. And
it's frustrating, isn't it? It's very frustrating work. It's not something where you're going to always have all those thank yous and rewards. That's for sure. Okay. Any others here?
We talked about that sometimes we cop out on the spiritual end. We expect the pastor to take care of that.
Uh-huh.
But then often they come to the church and the secretary refers them. I'm usually to the pastor.
Okay.
But we probably cop out on that too.
Well, how to get the folks in the congregation involved in that personally, and so that it isn't just something they hear about. That's a good point, too. Any other creative ideas here that we haven't brought up yet?
We have an ecumenical group of a cluster of churches, of Catholics and Nazarenes, Presbyterians, all in the northeast area of Portland, and they're working together trying to get workers and employers together. To get jobs or jobs in transition.
All right. Good.
Yes.
We have the churches in our town that cooperate with through the fish program and the welfare department.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And they have a turn, like probably 4 or 5 days a month.
Okay.
Turns for each church, and the referrals that come from the welfare are provided with food during that.
Okay, it's a cooperative program again. This is happening all over. Churches cooperating, yes.
And that we also have a garden produce now in the summer. The different churches set up a certain day. Now, our church has Tuesday. The farmers that have, or the gardeners that have surplus products, bring them in, and they can come to us and come there in the afternoon and pick up fresh produce. And I know Trinity has Saturday. And I think some of the other churches in the area do the same thing on different days.
Okay, fine. I'm just going to cut you off there. We got a lot of good ideas. The main thing is I wanted to do some sharing so that you begin to get some new and creative ideas from other people, and then to realize that churches can be very creative, and often we have to work together with other churches to do this the best. What would you say is that you can turn your chairs back again now and face this direction? What would you say is the, well, two or three things that we could learn from this parable? What would be one thing?
Share.
Get involved. Get involved.
Cooperation.
Have a little more courage. Yes.
Say hello to your neighbor at church.
Say hello to your neighbor at church.
I thought the sharing of the peace, no one else thought this was a great idea. But we're not used to it.
Uh-huh.
I don't know. But, and we always feel, isn't this sorry? But I thought that sometimes you can go to a church that you don't know, and the one on the other side of you knows, and folks, and you never have met anybody.
Yeah.
But this way you meet somebody.
Yeah, that's
so I think when we get used to it, it would be a neighborly thing.
That's right. To shake hands with people, or hug them, or however you feel like.
Now,
at that
hugging,
point.
I think that's going a little far.
It's however you feel comfortable. So, just so you don't go so far as to kiss somebody.
All you do about the scripture that says, greet them with a holy kiss.
Yes, that's right. So it all depends on where you're at, right? Yes.
Okay, what about, say, a family that lives in in Salt Lake City, for instance? The helping hand is very great there. If you are a non-church, and it seems to stop if you know.
If you're not a Mormon.
If you're not a Mormon, but at the same time, how is the Christian church relating to other people that are doing God's will as far as being a neighbor?
As far as whether we agree with the Mormons and their approach, I mean?
We appreciate them, yes, but at the same time, what is our stance as far as we see them using help and friendliness to bring others to their religion?
Oh, I see. But if you don't become a Mormon, then they stop helping you?
Yeah. Well,
right.
Yeah, that's basically what is true of the Mormons. They're caring about their own is a thing to be commended, and those who are potentially Mormons, but I certainly do not agree with the fact that that's where it stops, and we Christians have responsibility to help those who are not Christians or are not our own. We have a responsibility to reach out a whole lot farther than that model of love, even though it's very nice within the Mormon Church. That's, any other opinions on that?
How do we speak to that?
Yeah.
I know of two instances where just by their Mormons being kind to a Lutheran, they won them from the Lutheran Church into Mormonism because they said nobody in the Lutheran Church cared as much about me as these Mormons.
Yeah, yeah. Well, this is true, and they do this, but like Ruth said, they will often stop if you don't show any signs of becoming a Mormon.
Yeah, but they are so eager to help. I know of one lady that's confined to a nursing home, and I don't know of any of us Lutherans who go in there and take these cripples and carry them to the door and put them in a car, take them to the services, keep them overnight.
That's what they're doing.
Right.
This lady was a good Lutheran before, but she said, nobody did anything like that for me before they came along. So they look for those places where they can kind of pry in and because of their kindness win them.
We can learn this from the Mormons too, that we should take care of our own.
That's right.
I know so. We expect people to give generously to the church. We say tithe or whatever we say. And yet I wonder if we shouldn't therefore also be ready to help the person who maybe has been generous and all of a sudden has bad luck and goes broke and has problems. We should say, okay, our church therefore should keep that person going. Maybe we should, that's what the Mormons do. We should learn from them about that too. Yes.
Yes, in our church over the last couple of years, we've had two instances of bad health, the families of mediocre means. And the pastors have exerted an effort to make this known to the large congregation, and it's been just amazing what they've been able to get in.
Yeah.
So one man was on a dialysis machine, and they helped pay for his treatment and also for care at the University of Minnesota.
Yeah.
And the other one fell out of a tree and is paraplegic as a result of it, and we practically rebuilt his home.
Yeah, those are some fine examples of that kind of thing. That's excellent. Well, there's lots of lessons we could learn from this. I'd like to just share with you a few things that some folks said when they discussed this parable, folks in Nicaragua. This is the source of what I'm going to read at this point. The Gospel in Salentiname by Ernesto Cardenal. He writes, he's a priest, he writes, he records the conversations of his parishioners in this village in Nicaragua. And as they read the parable, they read the scripture, and then they discuss it. And here's some of the discussion on the part of underprivileged people, third world people, which I'd like to have you hear. Loviano says, in trying to catch Jesus in a trap, this lawyer, this teacher, was the one who fell into the trap. Jesus makes him say things he doesn't do. Another guy says, maybe he wanted to argue with him about worship in the temple, the Sabbath, unclean food, purification, and many other laws that were nonsense. And Jesus makes him say what's important, loving God and your neighbor. And then they go on and discuss the parable itself. And one fellow says, he gave the Samaritan as an example, a person of another race and another religion, so we can know that everybody is a neighbor. He gave us an example who is an enemy. Manuel says, some take care of the temple, but not of neighbors, and so they're evil. This one didn't take care of the temple, but he took care of neighbors, and he was a heretic, and he's the good one. Another guy says, the first two, the priest and the Levite, it was their temple duties they were devoted to. It was religion itself that prevented them from loving their neighbors, and that kind of thing is still going on. Claudiano says, being charitable to the poor, giving them worn-out clothes, isn't loving your neighbor. Love of your neighbor is comradeship, because that man not only cared for the wounded man, but he took him to a hotel and paid for his room and said he'd pay for anything extra when he came back. And of course, from then on, they remained friends. They were comrades. The atheists, who are revolutionaries, are called the good Samaritans of the parable, the good companion, the good comrade. The priest says, the religious leader who goes to the temple is carrying out the first part of the double commandment, love God. The Samaritan does the second part, love your neighbor. Why does Jesus say to do likewise, like the second? Is it that the first part isn't as important? A fellow by the name of Elvis says, the fact is that in your neighbor there's God. It's not that love of God gets left out. It's that those who love their neighbor are right there loving God. And Laudiano says, the other poor bastards are loving something that doesn't exist. The priest says, when they judged Jesus, the main accusation against him was that he was against the temple. A Samaritan woman, another heretic, asked him if the temple of Jerusalem was the true one. And he answered her that now God wasn't going to be adored in the temple, but everywhere, in spirit and in truth. Listen to this. Since then, we Christians have filled the earth with temples, but Jesus taught us that the only temple is the human being. The man fallen by the wayside, he was the temple.
South American hippie, says, our enemies are also part of God because they're also human beings. If they do evil, it's because they're mistaken and we must love them. Love them and fight them to free them from the injustice they are committing. The devil is the one who's working here. Okay, that's just some thoughts from people from a different culture discussing this passage. May or may not like what they say, but I'm, you know, going to share some of those kinds of things with you from time to time. I also want to share with you just a little bit of what Jose Miranda, who is from Mexico, he wrote a book called Marx and the Bible. And speaking of Karl Marx, Karl Marx was not exactly what you call a good Christian. I mean, he didn't go around promoting Christianity, did he? Christianity. And yet, could you say that he may have a little in common with this Samaritan? See, Karl Marx was a fellow who had a great passion for those people who are hurting, the workers especially, who are being taken advantage of. And he lived a long time ago, so that a lot of things have happened between the time Karl Marx lived and now. And certainly a part of what we call Marxism, or it's labeled Marxism in our world today, is atheistic Marxism, and Marx claimed to be an atheist, and so a lot of it is violent, and we have the Soviet, the Russian branch of politics, and that which claims Karl Marx as their originator. But you also have a lot of Western European kind of caring through socialism, democratic socialism, and they too claim Karl Marx as the one who gave them their ideas. Karl Marx was a person who mainly cared about people and saw the church as not caring. And I wonder if he isn't too far from being that Samaritan that this guy talks about. Well, anyway, Marxism and some of the basic ideas of Karl Marx and his caring, his deeply caring attitude about people who are being taken advantage of is being latched onto by many Latin American liberation theologians. Of course, what's happening is that those who are really scared of that, who every time they hear the word Marx, they see a red flag and they get all excited and say, this is bad, this is wrong. And they write articles in Reader's Digest and they do all kinds of things. But we need to be very careful to not be sucked in by those oversimplifications. To realize that Karl Marx, and Fritz Norstedt says this too, and he's worked in South America a lot. In South America, in Latin America, the Marxists are our friends. And he tells about them, how they meet, you know, like for Bible study early in the morning. They call themselves Marxists, many of them that are deeply committed Christians. And we need to be careful when you ask the question, can a Marxist be a Christian, or are Marxists all bad or all good? You need to be very careful to ask the question, you know, who is it, what are they doing, and to really examine the question carefully, rather than to simply oversimplify and jump to conclusions like so many are doing nowadays. Anyway, I want to read just a little bit of Jose Miranda's treatment of the Good Samaritan parable. He says, according to Luke 10, one time that Jesus explained the meaning of you must love your neighbor as yourself, he put forth not just any man, but a man who had suffered injustice and violence and needed help from someone who was able to have compassion on him. In the Ten Commandments, he goes on to say, there is a practical sense of interhuman justice, of authentic compassion, in which, and only in which, the true God reveals himself, not to be confused with other gods. If listen kind of carefully to what he says, because he writes some pretty heavy stuff. The first part of the law, that is, you know, worship God or love God above all else, these first two commandments wish only to present God as unconfused. In the last seven, or however you number the commandments, the imperative of justice, in which this God reveals himself as different from all other gods, is made inescapable.
Let me just ask you a question. Suppose the priest and the Levite, or either one of them, had taken a second look at the man and said to himself, I probably ought to help him. It's my duty. It's my duty. If I don't help him, I'm gonna go home and feel so guilty. And then he hesitated and finally went over and helped him. What do you suppose Jesus would have said about that?
You have to go with your heart. You don't do it with love, you haven't.
It's an attitude you're getting at here, isn't it?
Yeah. That's like in the lip service or whatever.
Okay.
Only on a
type. All right. Do you know any Christians who go about their church work that way? Or go about their... Is there much joy in that? No, that's a real drag.
I still think Jesus would have preferred it.
He would have preferred it, yes. Yeah. Okay. But he's missing something, right? Okay.
Yes, but I certainly would think that the first one that went by, even if he did it out of sense of duty, it would have been better. The fellow would have well sinned.
You betcha. It would have been
Jesus
better.
Jesus would have approved.
Yeah, that's true. It would have been done, and Jesus would have approved, but he would probably have added a footnote. But gee, that guy's really missing something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe the Samaritan was the only one that had a beast to help carry the fellow
in. Did you all hear that?
No.
Any response to that one?
Maybe the Good Samaritan was the only one who had a beast to carry him in.
Maybe he had a horse that would protect him.
But it's awful easy to say someone else has more money or something to help that person with, too.
Yeah, they have a car, and they can do it.
Okay, you're baiting us, weren't you? Yeah, I think so.
I think once you get involved in something that you are sort of squeamish about, though, you can work up some enthusiasm so you really find that you really enjoy what you're doing.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. That's excellent. Sometimes we can begin to do something out of duty and discover it's a lot of fun. Okay. So that there's a good point there. Yes. You one over here.
I haven't heard any of this. So I'm probably. Anyway, the priest or the Levite feels guilty and goes back, and there is a Samaritan working. What did you do?
Oh,
is he going to cooperate with the Samaritan and say, gee, I want to help in this matter?
Yeah.
Or is he going to say, good, somebody else is taking care of it, now I can get busy with my own duty?
Yeah, that's the other, you know, who knows what he would have done, but there's all kinds of possibilities. Let me just share with you what a fellow by the name of Jose Bonino writes. He's got a little book called Doing Theology in a Revolutionary Situation. He's also Latin American. He's about the only Protestant that we have writing liberation theology. His little book, it's in the bookstore too. Here's what he said. He's from Argentina, I believe. He says, what about, and this ties in with our original question that we asked when we started, what about men of goodwill or non-Christians who embrace the same liberating historical praxis as Christians, that is, who really care about people and do things to help? Curiously enough, we have reversed the biblical concern with this problem. The question that I raised at the beginning, what about these so-called non-Christians who help? By asking that question, we have come at the Bible in the wrong way, he says. The service of love, the trust, the goodness of the non-believer is presented in the Bible not as a problem, but as a sign of God's free and universal grace, and as a call to repentance and conversion. In other words, God is so great and so big, he's doing all kinds of things we aren't even aware of. Humility and praise, not confusion, is the proper response to those kinds of things. And he goes on and discusses it quite a bit. And there are so many other aspects of things we could discuss. What about when your church, when a church that's well established finally leaves the central city and moves out to the suburbs, and then you leave the central part of the city to some group that you call the Holy Rollers or all kinds of groups whose theology you don't agree with. Are they God's church? And they really move in there and they really care about those people and they seem to somehow relate to them and help them.
should we, maybe we have a responsibility to go back and say, we'd like to help you. We want to get tied in with you some way. Or if you're in a suburban congregation, is your church being tied in with some inner city congregation? Just to get, send some representatives back and forth to say, how could we help? I know in my work in inner city churches, this has been a great thing. When a congregation, the people from the social concerns committee in the congregation have said, we want to come and meet with your social concerns committee. We want to see how we can work together, since we work in different parts of the community. That's the kind of thing that can be very practical too, as well as the global picture. And Lutheran World Action, Lutheran World Relief, has the lowest overhead of any of those agencies. The more of the money, more of the help goes to helping people than anything else.
Yeah. Just one quick thought. I think that's something that the Lutherans really ought to take a long, serious look at, because the young people are being drawn by other churches, and we're going to have to pray pretty hard about that.
Okay.
We don't know why, but they are.
And sure, they are very perceptive, and they know what's really phony and what isn't, and where people are caring. Well, Jesus talked about love, and he gave us some ideas. All I can say is, like Jesus said at the last, go and do likewise. Thanks for coming.